Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 107, the 115th American Psychological Association Convention, August 22nd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. I'm going to follow a somewhat different format today, starting right out with some announcements, and then I'll be talking about the American Psychological Association Convention. So right at the outset here, I want to acknowledge our sponsors, Podshow. You can subscribe to this show, along with a lot of other good shows, at podshow.com. And also to thank GoDaddy.com for their support. And remember that you can use Shrink3 at checkout to get some good discounts at GoDaddy.com. I want to call your attention to the fact that there is a new podcast up on my other podcast site, which is wisecounselpodcast.com. And I interview Stephen Levenkron, who is a New York psychotherapist who's written a book called Stolen Tomorrows, Understanding and Treating Women's Childhood Sexual Abuse. So if you're at all interested in that topic, I think you're going to really appreciate that particular interview. Today's Shrink Wrap Radio episode is a kind of sampler of the 115th APA, American Psychological Association Convention, that was held in San Francisco. It took place over a four-day period, and I went down to the city for two of those 4 days. I found that sitting through some of the larger presentations and then trying to interview the speaker afterwards was not terribly effective, because then the speaker would be mobbed by people with questions, and then sometimes they had to rush off to another presentation. So I discovered an alternate strategy, which was to interview some of the people who are doing poster presentations. Now, you may not know what a poster presentation is. I didn't know up until fairly recently. It's kind of like if they had the science fair when you were in high school. It's something like that. There are so many people who want to present. They need to do it to climb the academic ladder. You know, they need to publish. They need to do presentations at conferences. And it's hard for APA to accommodate everybody. Did I mention that there were supposedly 16,000 psychologists in this one place, at this one convention? And so to accommodate everybody who wants to be able to present, they have what are called poster sessions, where at about 100 people at a time, they will, down in a basement hall, they'll have an area set up with bulletin boards where people can tack up large posters that describe their research, the hypothesis, the method, and the findings. And then that researcher stands by that poster for an hour or two while people circulate through and review all of this. And a lot of students get to present that way. And also some regular PhDs are relegated to those sorts of presentations. So since those people are standing around just hoping somebody will notice them, I found that was a good source of interview material for me. So none of these interviews are terribly long, and it's meant to be kind of a sampler to kind of give you a bit of the feel of being there at APA, and so I hope you enjoy it. I'm here with Greg McCurry, who is a retired FBI agent, and I just heard him give a fascinating presentation on criminal profiling and the role that psychology can play in that. So let me start off by asking you, how many years were you an agent?
A little over 25 years.
And I'm under the impression that people get into the FBI either by having been police officers or attorneys or tax accountants. Your way in was?
through the diversified program. That's kind of a myth that you have to be an accountant or a lawyer or have a law enforcement background. There are different, there are like five different programs you can come in under, and some of it can be, it could be law and accounting, could be science, could be language, could be, but then there's a diversified, which can be any sort of background, and that's how I came in. I'm not a lawyer or an accountant, but it's basically a four-year college degree, minimum age 23, but the new agents are generally around 28 because we like to see them have some real-life experience and that we can judge them by.
Okay, and did I correctly get the impression that maybe you were involved in setting up the profiling unit in the FBI?
I was in the group sort of original profilers, or we began doing that back in the 1980s, and it became sort of a subset within the behavioral science unit of profiling. So I was in that first wave of profilers that came through the Bureau.
I recently retired from teaching psychology, and there were a lot of young things who wanted to be, you know, young women who wanted to become criminal profilers. And even right after your talk here, you were mobbed with a similar crowd. So what is your advice to my listeners who maybe would like to get into this?
I don't want to shatter anyone's dream, but it's a difficult thing to get into. The Bureau right now, for example, the FBI, we have maybe about 30 profilers. That's out of 13,000 agents. So, and we take our profilers from our agent population. So to become an FBI profiler, first you have to become an agent, and then, you know, I draw the analogy, it's like being a starting quarterback in the NFL. Those jobs are out there, but they're hard to come by and hard to get.
Yeah, that would be my impression. Now, I think you mentioned that you got a master's degree in psychology. Any PhD psychologists in that unit?
Yes. Yeah, we have some PhD psychologists in the unit as well. It's the blending of those disciplines that become important of having a good understanding, I think, of psychopathology as well as criminal investigations and crime and crime scenes. So it's a wedding of those two disciplines that can be helpful.
You covered an awful lot of ground. One of the things that stood out for me was you said when you go to a murder scene, one of the things that you look for is, did the murderer do something that was unnecessary? Maybe you could say a bit about that, give an example.
Yes. In other words, when someone does something, an offender does something he doesn't have to do, we're analyzing all offender behavior. And the most important thing are the things that an offender does that he didn't have to do. For example, if it was a murder scene, he went there and murdered the victim, but yet he covered her up and put her on a couch and put her head on a pillow and all of that, which was one of the cases I went through. Those are all things that he didn't have to do to affect the murder. But that is what will distinguish that offender from anybody else. And that in that particular case, that sort of caring concern we see is an indication of a prior relationship with the victim. There is some caring and concern for the victim that they treated her nicely, put her on a couch and covered her up and so forth. And in that particular case, it turned out to be her son who was the murderer.
I ended up getting invited to be co-author of a book in which I ended up doing a analysis of the Zodiac serial killer based on the letters that he wrote. With no training as a profiler, but being a clinical psychologist, used my clinical judgments. Did the FBI do any profiling of the Zodiac that you're aware of?
I think they did, although I didn't do it when I was with the Bureau. I think that they did take a look at the case over the years. But certainly any communication from the offender is very, very important because that is another avenue that directly into him, and that content analysis and all that, that becomes one important factor if we have that in a case, as in the Zodiac case.
Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, well, Shrink Wrap Radio listeners will know that I've been tracking the issue that's very divisive right now in APA as to whether psychologists should be involved in any way in interrogations and military interrogations. And I'm sitting with two psychologist activists in that area and just now meeting them. And so I just want to hear a little bit about what the latest on that is. And so I'm sitting with
Stephen Reisner.
And Stephen, you are, your affiliations?
Well, right now I say that my affiliation is the Coalition for an Ethical APA. I also am senior faculty at the International Trauma Studies Program in New York. I'm on the faculty of the NYU Medical School. But my main affiliation right now is the Coalition for an Ethical APA.
Okay, and another Stephen here across from me.
Stephen Solds, and I'm also from the Coalition for an Ethical APA and a professor at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis.
Okay, so we have heavy academic hitters here. So, you know, you just heard me give a capsule summary of the issue. Maybe you have some things to say that take us beyond that.
Well, it seems to me that what makes this really important is that it is very rare for the American Psychological Association to make a decision that has such serious real-world consequences. We've seen in the last few months evidence, irrefutable evidence, that the program of abusive interrogations tantamount to torture at detainee sites like Guantanamo, at CIA black sites, have been developed and overseen and spread to detainee sites throughout the world by psychologists. That psychologists were behind the creation of those techniques and programs of interrogation. They spread them and are primarily responsible for overseeing the government's program of abusive detainees.
Yes, I read actually a shocking account, which maybe you've seen in, I think it was last week's New Yorker, and where they were invoking concepts like learned helplessness and using, you know, learned helplessness was a problem, right? And they've turned it into a technique to induce learned helplessness. I was shocked.
Yeah, well, what's been documented over the last several years and then irrefutably demonstrated, as Stephen was saying, in the last number of months, is that the military SEER program, the Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, that was designed to train U.S. troops to resist breaking under torture, has been reverse engineered by psychologists from SEER and other military psychologists to develop abusive interrogation techniques. Some of those, Mitchell and Jessen, who worked in the CIA black sites, have used this learned helplessness business as part of it. But another a critical part of the role of psychologists is as a legal protection. The administration has redefined torture so that action, no matter how brutal it is only torture if the intent is to hurt people. By getting psychologists with their doctorates and all their prestige to say this is the way to get information, they were hoping that this would help protect them from future war crimes trials, because then they could say our intent wasn't to hurt, we were just following professional advice. So this implicates the entire profession of psychology, because it's our expertise and our prestige that is being used to justify, to protect the torturers.
How did we psychologists get dragged into this?
I wish that we were dragged into it. It doesn't seem to me that we were necessarily dragged into it. There was, after September 11th, the Bush administration changed American policy of interrogations, you know, that was in place for decades. I'm not saying that we didn't torture before. Everybody knows that there was torture under the tutelage of the CIA in the past, but it was never made overt public policy. And it became public policy after September 11th, when certain high-value detainees were captured for the highest level of the Defense Department and the administration to want to squeeze information out of these detainees and to do it quickly. And they needed to find people who were willing to do that. And they found consultants as the beginning, the psychological consultants to SEER training, which were Mitchell and Jessen apparently, and eventually others, who weren't dragged into it. They seemed to welcome the opportunity to expand psychology's purview into this arena, and I think they have unfortunately dragged down the name of psychology into the muck of unethical and illegal behavior with them.
It's a slippery slope. So what's the resolution of this going to be? What's happening here at APA? What are the chances that this is going to get turned around?
Well, it's a complicated process that we don't have time to go into in detail, but the APA leadership has always stated we're against torture, but in some sense it's been with a wink and a nod. They're against torture, at least in the past, they've been against torture in the same way the Bush administration has been against torture. Everyone is against torture. We just never see it. No one ever does it. And so tomorrow there's a possibility that this may change. there are various proposals and there's complex negotiations going on, but if the right versions pass, it would finally put the American Psychological Association and the psychology profession on record as being unequivocally against torture and against psychologists being on there. However, it's still not clear what the final wording is going to be, and as usual, the devil is in the details.
Okay, well, the two doctors, Steve, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
And quite all right.
Okay, I'm here at a poster session with an undergraduate student from Penn State University, and the title of her presentation is The Price We Pay for Withholding Our Negative Emotions. And I think most of us have a sense that we pay some kind of price. Tell us about your research.
Okay. Well, in our research, we explored the relationship between emotional regulation and physical health. In order to do this, we drew upon the self-determination theory, which states that we manage our emotions in different ways. There are two broad categories of this theory. One says we regulate our emotions externally, according to the rules of society.
You sound like you've memorized this.
Somewhat, thank you. And then on the other end of the spectrum is internal regulation, which is high in autonomy. You will either withhold your emotions or express them by a sense of free will. You identify with the regulation and its stature, and you are comfortable in your decision and the emotions. So our hypothesis was that those who were more externally regulated would have worse health, and those who were internally regulated would have better health.
Makes sense to me. Did it come out that way?
Well, it held true for the externally regulated in the sense that we attained many significant negative correlations on 6 of the 8 health subscales.
Okay. And you know what? We forgot to get your name.
I am Caroline Anderson.
Caroline, thanks so much. Good luck as you continue your studies.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm still cruising the poster sessions here, and the title of this one kind of caught my attention, Psychological Characteristics of Forgiving Women. And so tell us a little bit about who you are and your involvement.
My name is Greg McCracken, and I'm the third name on the poster, so this wasn't particularly my study. But what we were looking at was the common traits of forgiving women, and the main ones we were looking at were trait sympathy, social desirability, and self-esteem, which all had high correlations. And one we kind of threw in at the end, kind of on a whim, was pet closeness. And we found that there was a positive correlation between the closeness to one's pets and forgiving women.
Interesting.
Yes.
Now, do you have a girlfriend?
I have a fiance. Yes.
And is she a forgiving woman?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you know?
Well, she's forgiven me once or twice, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck with your studies.
Thank you very much.
Okay, one of those wonderful things just happened to me that I positively live for. Here I am wandering around APA, and somebody comes up to me and says, "Hi, are you Dr. Dave by any chance?" Tell us about you.
My name's Brad Montgomery. I'm a doctoral student at Northern Illinois University, and I just came to the Bay Area for an internship.
All right.
And be working at the VA.
And you're a listener to Shrink Wrap Radio?
Yeah, I have been for about 8 months or so. I found you by accident on the podcast, you know, and I've really enjoyed the interviews and stuff that you do, you know. It's been really informative.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for saying hi, and if you listen at the end of the week, you'll hear yourself interviewed.
All right, good. It's good to talk with you.
Likewise.
Take care.
Okay, well, here's a very interesting presentation called MySpace, Psychological Friend or Foe, and you are?
I'm Kimberly Morse.
And you're a student at?
I'm actually a law student right now, but I'm a graduate of Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida.
Okay, and tell us about your study. You know, we're all interested in MySpace. Mm-hmm. What was your question and what did you find out?
My question was about whether or not interacting on MySpace for larger amounts of time per day or just interacting on MySpace more frequently would cause, or not cause, but whether or not people had lower self-esteem. They used MySpace more often. That's what my question was.
And what did you find out?
I found a significant correlation between higher amounts of time spent on MySpace and lower amounts of self-esteem.
So in other words, if I'm not feeling that great about myself, I'm more likely to hang out in a place like MySpace?
We don't really know causation, but we do realize that the people that are spending time on MySpace have lower levels of self-esteem.
Okay, and if you were to do a follow-up on this study, what would you want to do next?
I would probably want to find out whether or not people start out with lower self-esteem levels and then go on MySpace and have even lower ones, or if they start out with higher self-esteem and become having lower self-esteem once they spend more time on MySpace.
Now, here comes the real question. Okay. Do you hang out on MySpace?
I do currently have a MySpace right now. But while I was doing the study, I did not use MySpace for 8 months so that I could.
And did you feel any withdrawal?
I actually did. That was one of the reasons why I ceased the MySpace usage, because I wanted to see if I felt that addiction that I was asking other people about.
Well, I'm terribly addicted to technology myself, as you can see by the fact that I'm sticking a microphone in your face.
Okay, I know, we all are.
Yes, indeed. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Here's a very interesting exhibit called Disasters and Information, Improving Warning Compliance Decisions to Minimize Physical and Psychological Harm. So what's your name? What's your affiliation?
My name is Carla Vermeulen, and I'm a graduate student at Fordham University in their Applied Developmental Psychology Department.
Okay, and so what's the underlying question of this research here?
I'm trying to figure out how disaster warnings can be made more convincing so that citizens who receive them will actually be motivated to follow the recommendations and take protective action, sparing them then from being actually harmed in disasters.
Is there evidence that people tend to ignore those warnings?
Definitely. There's a lot of evidence that people tend to respond to disaster warnings with denial because, of course, the recommendations that they're making are often very onerous, things like evacuating, boarding up your house, and also the odds that the disaster will actually occur are often unknown. I mean, they usually don't know whether a hurricane is actually going to hit a particular area. So people really tend to go into denial. They find all sorts of reasons to avoid taking action. So my premise is that disaster warnings should be structured so they include three major components. First, there's a threat statement, which tells people, you know, what the actual hurricane or storm or whatever it is that's approaching. But then giving them the recommended actions, and finally a statement of consequences of what's going to occur if they don't take those actions. So doing it that way, I think, would shift people's attention from the uncontrollable threat to the controllable consequences. And then that would tend to break that denial.
Well, what do you think about the terrorist warnings that we've gotten, you know, of level orange or yellow, red or yellow or so on? How are they doing?
I think they're absurd. I think that, you know, people have become so inured to them that no one pays any attention whatsoever. I mean, I couldn't tell you what the warning level is right now. I don't think anyone pays attention to them. It's a constant false alarm at this point.
Yeah, it violates what you said about there sort of being an action consequence.
Exactly, right. And so again, that just reinforces itself with people. Like, they're not telling me what I should be doing about this, whatever code level it is. So I'm going to do nothing. Doing nothing so far has worked for me, so I'm going to go on doing nothing.
This seems like it could be a slippery phenomenon to study. Did you find some way to research this issue?
It is very difficult to research. This current study is just an ex post facto case study using newspaper accounts of Hurricane Katrina as the data source. And the results that I found from this, of course, are not causal in any way. But I did find a lot of ways to critique what the official warnings were and how they failed to follow this three-part system. So my next step with research is to figure out how to try and do this experimentally so I can try and look for some kind of causality.
And Carla, you're a doctoral student now, so what area of psychology are you studying?
My program is applied developmental psychology, but my personal interest is disaster psychology. But again, I'd really rather focus on figuring out ways to prevent people from experiencing disasters in the first place, rather than, there are a lot of very smart people working on ways to treat trauma afterwards, but I'd rather stop it in the first place.
What's your dream job after you get your PhD?
Oh boy, I honestly don't know. Not running FEMA. possibly something working with the Red Cross or some other kind of agency that actually does play an active role in issuing warnings and trying to protect people and get them to take protective actions.
Okay, well, you've got to get a clear image of the job you want in order to draw it to you.
Right. I'm working on that.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thank you.
I am in front of an exhibit that says The Changing Landscape of Academic Jobs in Psychology. Okay, and I'm speaking to
Matt Hertenstein.
Okay, Matt, and what did you find out here? Because some percentage of people that listen to this show are, in fact, probably planning careers in psychology. So how's the job landscape changing?
Well, first of all, what we did is we coded the ads in the APA Monitor for what academic positions or what institutions who were seeking academics were asking of the candidates in terms of their graduate transcripts, vita, effectiveness of teaching, and whatnot. And we coded every 5 years from 1979 to 2004. And what we found is essentially that more is being asked of applicants than ever before for all institution types.
I'm so glad I'm retired now from academia.
Yeah, doesn't it make you feel good? And baccalaureate institutions are becoming more and more interested in the research credentials of candidates.
Yes, I'm aware.
And likewise, research doctoral institutions are at least asking for more and more evidence of teaching interests, teaching effectiveness, and whatnot. So whether that really maps onto committees' decisions, that's another question, but they're at least asking for it now.
Yeah, that was a huge issue at the university that I recently retired from, where people were supposedly hired for teaching ability. Our institution had a strong history of teaching orientation, but more and more they were demanding proof of research. And I have one colleague who has won every teaching award possible, but her feet are being held to the fire because she hasn't published enough. Are you involved in this research?
Yes, my name is Pam Propsom, and I'm a co-author on the paper with Matt.
Okay, would you like to make a comment?
Let's see. The good news is there's more tenure-track jobs out there than there were in 1979, the first year that we looked at the ads.
Okay, I think that's due to the fact that my generation is retiring now.
Well, we thank you for that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
You are?
Dr. Dora Chase-Orn.
Okay, and you're from the?
Phillips Graduate Institute.
Well, I'm really snagged by the title of your presentation here, which is Why Teach the Holocaust to Psychology Graduate Students? So, why indeed?
I think in the end, the transformative properties of exploring and learning about the Holocaust make us better psychologists.
Okay, well, I would tend to agree with that. Now, did you do any sort of research to support this?
The research that I've done is, anecdotally, we know that, for the most part, we don't teach the Holocaust to psychology graduate students. And because that was anecdotal, everyone can agree, we don't teach it. We needed a study that looked at, do we teach it? So the study I did was to examine, do we teach it in California, at least, to psychology graduate students? And the answer was, no, we don't teach it.
There are so many other there are so many things to teach. I mean, for example, what about, I mean, I guess you could say maybe we're in denial. Is that a concern? We can't see your shrug.
You can't see my shrug?
Not on the mic.
It's not so much about denial. It's more about the humanizing effect of studying the Holocaust. It allows you to see and really feel and experience oppression, discrimination, the importance of tolerance, the real diversity that exists.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that with us, and good luck as you march on.
Thank you very much.
So now I'm standing in front of a poster that says Teaching Tolerance, Post 9/11 through Foreign Feature Films. Oh, you are?
Dr. Mary Miners.
Okay, and Dr. Mary Miners, what led you to do this?
Well, I started out with foreign films as a way of illustrating various psychological concepts. And I noticed that when I started introducing foreign films, students commented about the other cultures and what they had learned from them. So then I started making it an assignment. They would have to identify at least one cultural similarity and describe the scene that supported that. I found, as a result, that 79% of the students felt that it really contributed to their understanding of another culture, in addition to understanding of psychological concepts outside of the classroom.
I'm wondering if you showed any films that were made in Iraq or Iran or that part of the world.
Well, one of them about suicide, Taste of Cherry, by one of Iran's leading directors, is one that they have chosen. But Osama, which is one about a young girl who, because her mother or her brother and her father were killed, the only way she and her mother could survive is for her to disguise herself as a boy. So it's a very sad tale, and certainly students have said this gives me a greater understanding of the Middle East.
Okay, well, thank you very much. This sounds like good work. I'm in the commercial exhibit area right now, and I'm in front of an exhibit that touts evidence-based ADHD assessment tools for professionals. So, and I'm talking to Dr. Thomas Pedigo?
Pedigo.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about what your, I guess it's a software product.
This is an evidence-based system that combines parent ratings and teacher ratings with three cognitive measures of executive function. That allows you to incrementally add the evidence for and against a diagnosis, therefore working on the reducing the over-identification rate of ADHD by using incremental evidence. Evidence that is counter to a diagnosis is actually subtracted from the model.
Okay, so it sounds like this is solving a problem. It's designed to solve a problem. What's the problem that you're solving?
The problem that we're addressing is a tendency to rely too heavily on behavior ratings alone, which can lend to overdiagnosis of ADHD. And by combining an evidence-based model, looking at the science and the relative weight of each component that you are evaluating, you're allowed to use the real-world evidence that's available for you, as well as your clinical judgment. And when you put the two together, you have an excellent outcome.
It sounds fascinating. And are you also comparing then the scores against some kind of national norms?
They are. They're based on the base rate in the population in general at 4%. The normative database for the PADS program is a nationally normed sample of both ADHD and non-ADHD children.
This sounds like it's a breakthrough in or a significant advance in the field. What do you think?
That's our attempt. That's to try to improve upon both psychometrically as well as the presentation to the children taking the test. These measures were designed to be much more enjoyable and engaging for children as opposed to just working on boredom and frustration.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pedigo.
Thank you.
I'm in front of a commercial booth that says, strengthen your brain, sharpen your mind, the only scientifically proven brain fitness program for a vibrant life. Tell us who you are and a little bit about what you're selling.
Alrighty. We're Posit Science, and we have, as you said, developed a scientifically based program that is designed to not only improve cognitive function in an elderly population, but ideally delay cognitive decline.
So this is specifically targeted at the elderly.
Currently, correct. We're starting to have a lot of interest from the baby boomer market, and they're starting to purchase and use the program as well, but it was designed with an elderly population in mind. So it's something that's very user-friendly, it's very easy to use, even though the exercises themselves can become quite difficult as you're going through it. But the concept is that it's a very adaptive. There are six different exercises, and it's working on the concept of brain plasticity. So as someone starts to get better at an exercise, it's becoming more difficult so that the brain is constantly engaged and people are really constantly working at their threshold. Our goal being to drive physical change in the brain.
Okay, yes, there is a lot of recent evidence that we can grow new neural pathways, and kind of grow our brains, right?
Not only that, in fact, the reason we're here is there's a poster that's going to be presented on Monday. We ran a group of people that were diagnosed with MCI through the...
Wait, what is that?
Sorry, mild cognitive impairment, sort of the precursor to Alzheimer's disease. We ran them, half of them through the program, half of them through a similar computer-based concept, but it wasn't our adaptive training program. They were reading the New York Times online and playing a computer game called Myst. So after everyone completed all 40 sessions, they took both groups and gave them a functional MRI. The group that went through the POSIT training program, we actually saw physical changes to the hippocampal region of the brain. It was actually starting to grow.
Wow.
Wow, indeed. And we saw that growth maintaining a year later.
Wow. Double wow.
Double wow. And in the control group, the folks that didn't go through the training program, a lot of them, within that year, converted into dementia.
Triple wow. Now, I'm curious, what does it cost?
For consumers, the single-user version for one person is $395, and the two-user version is $495. I was going to say it's 40 sessions, and they're repeatable. So you can do the 40 sessions, take a little time off, and then go through it again and again and again as many times as you would like.
Well, what sorts of cognitive tasks are involved, and why would they be better than working New York Times puzzles?
Because the New York Times crossword doesn't recognize when you're starting to figure it out and make itself harder as a result. All of the exercises are auditory-based, so you're having to do things like be able to discriminate between two highly confusable phonemes. You're having to remember a sequence of syllables. And part of what the program is doing is, as you're getting better, it's getting harder in terms of the speech processing levels are changing. With the syllables, you might have to remember bash, bill, can. And as it's getting harder and harder, it's bash, bill, can. So that your brain is really having to focus in to be able to catch that sequence.
I may have to get a copy of this.
Pretty good stuff. It's a very exciting place to be. It really is.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for stopping by.
Okay, why don't you introduce yourself?
Christopher Rosick. I'm a psychologist at the Link Care Center and clinical faculty at Fresno Pacific University in Fresno, California.
Okay, and I'm not even going to try to say the title of your presentation. It's quite a mouthful.
You want me to say it?
Yes.
Measuring homophobia and homonegativity among conservative religious persons, ideological concerns.
Okay, you see why I didn't want to say it. If you can't say it, so homophobia and homonegativity. What was your hypothesis, and what did you find?
Well, essentially, I wanted to look at what they call an ideological surround nature of instruments, assessment instruments. And when you're doing social science research on assessment instruments, how the ideology around the construction of the instrument makes a big difference, and it can create sort of a bias towards the results you're going to find.
Now, that's something that we used to be fairly blind to, right?
I think, generally speaking, so. Unless there's a lot of dialogue between different perspectives or different ideologies. In this case, more of a difference between, a conservative religious ideology and a more individualistic kind of secular ideology that I think sometimes goes into instruments like this, which we studied Gregory Herrick's attitudes towards lesbian and gay individuals. That's a very well-known scale.
Okay, so what did you find out?
Well, to summarize it, it seems that the correlations between that scale and conservative religion, which is a very robust correlation in the literature, is predominantly based on the moral and the items in the scale that address moral belief and beliefs about naturalness of homosexuality. So those items are ideologically... the perspectives are very different from the test constructors and the conservative religious individuals who would complete that, meaning they would endorse that morality. That would be very standard within a religious, conservative religious ideology. That would be normative for them. Within the world of the test constructors, that is deviant and offending. And so that's the way that the instrument seems to be scored.
Okay, I'm a little lost. What's the implication for the average person in the street, either the average gay person or the average religious fundamentalist person?
Well, my hope is that we need to have greater sensitivity to the ideology of both the test itself and the way it's constructed and the individuals in whom to whom it's being applied. And to say that something is homophobic, you can disagree with the value system, but to say that simply a moral perspective is homophobic doesn't seem to me to be good science. It seems to be science stepping outside the realm of just empirical basis and looking at trying to determine what values are, what values should be among very differing possibly populations or subgroups that you are assessing.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm talking to...
I'm Dr. Dean Bird, University of Utah School of Medicine.
And you've just called my attention to a very special session that you're chairing on Monday. Tell us what the focus of that session is.
It's, the focus will be on the advocacy relative to American Psychological Association. The idea basically is this. There is a principle that's called the Leona Tyler Principle. This was accepted by APA and never rescinded. And basically what this principle says is that the American Psychological Association should not make resolutions or position statements for which there is inadequate scientific evidence. That does not prevent psychologists from taking positions, but it prevents the American Psychological Association from taking positions where there's not adequate science behind it.
Well, it seems like the idea of adequate scientific evidence could be a slippery slope, since psychologists never seem to find any study to be adequate and always find flaws.
There are some that are better than others. You simply need to acknowledge those.
Okay, and I'm wondering if this cross-cuts at all the very contentious issue that's in front of everyone now of psychologists being involved in military interrogations.
Absolutely. I think that psychology simply needs to present what the science is behind that before they take the positions that they take. I'm not suggesting at all that the psychology should not have advocacy, but we need science behind that. So let's look at the facts first.
Okay, and do you have a position on that issue as to whether or not psychologists should be involved as mentors, consultants, researchers, etc., in relation to interrogation?
Personally, I do not. I need to know what the evidence is in terms of what their involvement is and whether or not their involvement is ethical. That is, if there is adequate science behind their methodology for their positions, I'm okay with that. But I think that that's an area that there needs to be a lot more science behind it.
Is your idea for doing the symposium triggered, in fact, by that event or by other concerns?
By other events. There's a book that's called Destructive Trends in Mental Health that was edited by Cummings and Wright. The book talks about the American Psychological Association and some of the positions that they've taken for which there's inadequate science.
Okay, I'm wondering if the... if the issues around gayness are involved in this?
That's certainly part of it. I don't think that's center stage to anything that they do. But the idea basically is that positions that involve diversity ought to include a wide range of diversity, including religious diversity. Just like this poster session you just witnessed is talking about religious values as being a part of the whole area of diversity.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Bye. I am standing in front of an exhibit that says The Implicit Personality Theory of Islam, and I'm here with Robert Smither from Rollins College in Winter Park. I was thinking Rollins was in Virginia.
That's Hollins.
Hollins, that's right. I've been to Hollins. So tell us, what is the Implicit Personality Theory of Islam?
Our idea was to look at the assumptions in Islamic faith about human nature and what a practicing Muslim might believe about how people really are. And so the Islamic view would maybe contrast with the Freudian view or the humanistic view or a behavioral view.
So how would you characterize the Islamic view?
Islam is very interesting in the sense that there's a huge emphasis on personal responsibility, that we cannot blame our environment or our genetics or our neurotic environment for our problems. Ultimately, we always have a choice in the behaviors that we choose to do.
Okay, and are there other salient dimensions that, in a way, that seems to me to fit very well with the humanistic ideal based on existentialist idea that we have to make choices and be responsible for our choices?
Definitely with the existential, not so much with the humanistic in the sense that in Islam there's a much less of an emphasis on individualism. There's a much greater emphasis on the family and the community of believers. And this is one way that Islam is different. An Islamic theory of personality would be different from a typical Western psychological theory. We tend to promote individualism as the basis of our psychology. From an Islamic perspective, it's the community of believers that should be the area of study or focus.
Okay. Are you Islamic yourself? I'm not sure what the right word is. Muslim?
No, I'm not. I'm a personality psychologist, and I got interested in this idea. Sociologists study how Protestantism affects personality, and I was interested in looking at Islam and looking at normal Islamic personality as opposed to the many studies we have about Islamic politics and things of that nature.
Well, I think that's a great idea, and I'm wondering, have you run this by or had it vetted by any Muslim psychologists or just Muslims generally?
You better believe it.
Good. I would be afraid to if I didn't myself.
Yes, I had experts in Islam check everything in the paper to make sure that I had represented the Quran and the Hadith accurately.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You got to go online.
I know.
Say that again.
Oh, I just wanted to say hi. I'm at APA, and I've heard your iPod.
The Shrink Wrap Radio podcast.
Radio, yeah.
Yeah, what's your name?
Hugh Knickerbocker.
And are you a student? Or?
I'm a graduate student at Marist College.
Where is that?
It's in Poughkeepsie, New York.
All right, so all the way from New York. I am so pleased that you said hello.
Yeah, well, it's nice to meet you.
And you're the second student that I've run into here that's kind of flagged me down and said, hey, aren't you the guy I've been listening to?
Yeah, well, I love everything science, and I did a search for psychology, and it came up, you know, on iTunes.
Oh, that's great. Well, help spread the word, okay?
Oh, definitely.
Have you heard or seen anything here at APA that you've been real excited by?
I saw Linehan earlier today, and she developed dialectical behavior therapy, and she did a discussion on suicide and treatment implications. It was pretty interesting.
I am sorry that I missed her, but actually she is on my to-do list for my Wise Counsel podcast. I hope to snag her for an interview.
Yeah, that would be great. And I also I saw the Bandura Q&A earlier today. It was very fun.
Yeah, I was there for the first half of that, too. Well, thanks so much for saying hi.
Definitely. Have a good day.
Bye. Okay, so I am talking to Dr. Joseph Sandford of Brain Train from Richmond, Virginia. And you're in front of a booth here that says Computerized Cognitive Training and Neurofeedback in One Easy-to-Use Powerful System. And it looks like it's targeted towards ADHD, ADD, learning disabilities. Tell us a bit about your product.
Okay. We have a easy-to-use cognitive training system that trains over 20 different areas of cognitive skills. It works with children, adolescents, and adults. It's designed primarily for professionals to use with their clients.
Okay, and so how does it work? Well,
the brain's just like a muscle. When you go to the gym and you exercise all the various muscles in your body, you get stronger. Well, the brain is the ultimate use it or lose it machine. And so as we develop over the course of our lives, we need to keep our brain active and to think and do new things. And these exercises help you to develop your mental muscles.
Okay, let me ask you, let me play devil's advocate a little bit. How is this not New Age hucksterism capitalizing on, you know, technology and so on?
Okay. Well, we've been in business over 18 years, and we've been working with people throughout the whole country and throughout the world. And our services have been used by many, many different professionals, and we have many published research articles on our software system. So people have used it in many different places. They've used it with a wide range of populations, and they've done independent research showing its effectiveness.
Wow, well, that's good. Now, you have a PhD, and it's in?
My PhD is in clinical psychology, and I specialize in neuropsychology and cognitive functioning of helping people with cognitive disabilities and problems with their cognitive functioning.
You know, I suspect you probably know what you're talking about.
Well, I certainly do enjoy my work, and I enjoy helping people. And one thing I do want to mention that we're doing that's a little bit unusual here, because many soldiers have been injured in the Afghan war and the Iraqi war, and the signature industry is head injury, we're now offering our software free. They can contact us, and they have to contact a health professional. Health professional has to recommend that this software be appropriate for them, and they can get the software to use at home for free in conjunction with a healthcare professional.
Excellent. And otherwise, how much would the software cost?
Well, the software varies. Our easiest to use system for home use is only $1 a day. That's $365 for a year's use, so people have plenty of time to use it, and there's discounts for families as well.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm very excited to be standing here with Dr. Mira Rastogi, who I've never met before in person, but...
Hi, everyone.
And we met how?
Oh, we met because I wanted to promote Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm a big fan and listener, and I'm also a professor at Edgewood College in Madison, Wisconsin. And I've learned a lot from Shrink Wrap Radio, and I also play segments in my classes.
All right.
And students really respond to it.
Oh, wow. That's what I love to hear. So it's so great to get to meet you in person. I actually read one of your letters on the air. Did you get to hear that, one of your emails to me?
You know, I tried to listen to him, but with coming to APA, I've been really busy, but I'm going to go back and I'm going to find it.
I shouldn't put you on the spot. You know, they say a lawyer should never ask a question that he doesn't know the answer to in advance. Not that I'm a lawyer, but I think the same principle might apply. So have you seen anything here at APA? It's been going on for 2 days now, I guess. Have you seen any presentations that got you excited, that blew your mind?
Yeah, I've been to a couple. I just went to one recently that was very interesting that talked about how to get students to use their textbooks and what appeals to students. And so they talked about whether it's effective to do quizzes or no quizzes. Does that get students to read more? How much do students say they read? How much do they actually read? And so they had the presenters had some ideas and also presented it in a really interesting manner, too.
Well, how do you get students to read their textbooks?
Well, they said in-class quizzes work the best. And then if you... there was something, I'd have to look at my notes, but they had another suggestion for if you do web-based quizzes, there's a particular way you can design the web-based quizzes, to prevent students from using the web to look up answers, so you decrease the time that the students have to answer, so they have to read the material before they answer the quiz, and so that, then you get almost equal rates of student performance in class and on the web.
Wow, that's very interesting. If I were still teaching, I'd want to know about that. But I guess that chapter's closed for me at this point.
I didn't know you stopped teaching.
Yeah, I think so. I have the right to be hired by my department, but money's tight there, and so currently they haven't offered me anything.
That's too bad, because you always, I notice when you interview people, you always ask about their teaching philosophy and different ways they explore different topics with their students. And
yeah, well, once a teacher, always a teacher, I guess. Okay, well, it's so great to meet you here.
Yeah, great to meet you, too. Thank you very much.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
This episode has run long enough that I think that'll wrap it up for today. I won't attempt to read any emails. I'm getting pretty far behind in the emails, but I think I'll have time to make that up in the very next episode. I do love getting your emails, so be sure to send them to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And of course, we have MyChingo, and there's a logo on the website where you can click on that.
In fairly short order, I plan to follow this show up with a second one. There were a few more interviews that I did. It won't run as long as today's show did on the interviews from APA, but there are some good ones there that I want to share with you. So next time we'll have more of the APA convention and we'll read some of your letters. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.